Hi, welcome to Sacred Conversations with Vision Battlesword. This is an audio series created by me and by the Sacred Light spiritual community for our own benefit as well as for anyone else that might be interested to hear it. This represents a new kind of podcast or a new type of audio series that I call a community conversation. So I'll be talking with the Sacred Light spiritual community and we'll explore all types of topics from truth to philosophy, spirituality, consciousness, psychedelics, and many, many more. And the goal of this is just to explore reality, to explore truth, and to see what all of the different pieces and all the different perspectives are of reality that we can put together into an integration of an entirely new philosophy. So I hope you'll join me for this journey, and without further ado, here's our episode. Thanks.
The phrase collective experiences of God has
been coming up for me.
Oh, really? Collective experiences of God.
Well, then I'll let you, that's one phrase that's in my head.
Well, thanks for sitting with me today for a sacred conversation. I'm really looking forward to this. I was really hoping that we would have an opportunity to do this while you're visiting in town. So thanks so much for taking some time and space. David Sauvage, I pronounced your name right?
You got it.
Who are you, David Sauvage?
You just started with the hardest possible question.
I like to get the hard ones out of the way off the bat.
Maybe. Can we bracket that question and come back to it?
You can answer it any way you want.
Yeah, I'm going to answer it with, I don't have the answer yet, both in my life and in this moment. But I think I'll have a better answer for it as the conversation unfolds.
Perfect.
But maybe in a trivial sense, I'm a friend of yours. I live in the Hudson Valley. I help people understand themselves in many different ways. I write and I think about a lot of the same things you think about.
I love that. Well, I'm sure we're going to uncover some of the things that we both think about over the course of the next hour or so. My name is Vision Battlesword. I am the founder of Sacred Light and the creator of the Power Activation, as well as a program for helping people with relationships called Intentional Autonomous Relating. And I'm the host of Sacred Conversations, which is what we're doing here today. And before we started, I heard you mentioned a phrase that's been coming up a lot for you recently. What was that again?
Collective experiences of God.
Collective experiences of God. And I came into this little conversational container with the idea that we might talk about money. And also I had an idea that we might talk about healing, which is all of those things, healing and money and God, all sort of somehow came up together into that collective experiences phrase. So what do you feel like talking about today?
Oh, I really enjoy being led. Although I'll say one thing before I'm led. I want to remark on a similarity we have, which is it's rare that I meet somebody who has as organized a mind as I have. And you have a very organized mind. And you also, as I do, have a certain fetish for precision. We have this in common. You, unlike me, have a very organized house. So my organization ends at my mind and does not tend to extend into my physical space the way I see yours does. So that's what I felt like saying up front.
Thank you for that. I take all that as a compliment. And I love that phrase that's never occurred to me before, but is on point in describing me, which is that I have a fetish for precision. You could call me a precisiophile, perhaps.
Yeah, I have something like that too.
I like that. I like that a lot. And I've often felt. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, yeah. If you looked at Vision Battlesword, you could see the fetish for precision. But if you looked at me, you wouldn't see it. Mm-hmm. You could easily see me as unkempt or messy. And if you walked into my house, you might have the same experience. So there is that weird difference between us two, even though I do feel like our minds are very similarly. They're not similarly organized. They are organized to similar degrees, but they are organized differently.
Well, I've always felt that fetish for precision from you, which is one of the things that's always attracted me to you and why I think we've gotten along as well as we have, just in sharing that. There's something special in that kind of intimacy. And I love that you brought that up and connected, you know, allowed us to connect on that as we're kind of getting started with this. For me, I thought when we were talking earlier that things were starting to get really juicy when we were getting into the topic of money. And there's a specific question that I asked you when we were having lunch moments ago that you said, I believe the exact thing you said was, that is the best question. And I said, okay, great, let's stop there. And I'll ask it. Let's just begin right where we left off, which is, what do you believe about money?
I'm pausing because I believe a lot of things, and some of those things are really complex. And I also see that my beliefs shift around it. So that's one thing I believe, is that what money means to us shifts. So money is ever shifting in its meaning. What money meant to me when I was a teenager is so different than what money means to me now when I'm 43. And what money means to you is different than what money means to me. And I think that that's more true of money than other things. So a car means something similar to me as it means to somebody else. But money changes its meaning based on who's talking about it and how they relate to it. Money is a story that we have somehow collectively granted our consent to or collectively agreed upon. Many of us have not consciously given our consent. I certainly do not give my consent, but I am still part of a web of interdependencies held together by money that we are all in through some kind of unconscious, or in some cases, I suppose, conscious agreement. And I don't think it's right to say, as most people who believe they feel deeply into money often say, that money is just energy. I think that that isn't true. I don't think money is just energy. I think money is much closer to a unconscious agreement of how resources are meant to flow. Money is an unconscious agreement made by human beings around how resources are meant to flow. And another thing I'll say about money, and we can go at it at so many different levels. I'm closing my eyes because I'm trying to really feel into all these different ways of thinking about it and feeling into it. Another way we can think about money is that money is a projection of the resolution of our unmet needs. So money on one level is a series of, is a story that we've all agreed on about how resources are meant to flow. On another level, money is a projection of our unconscious of what will meet our unmet needs. So if I feel like I am hungry, I think I need money in order to eat. Or if I feel like I am sad, I often think I need money in order to make myself happy. Or for me, I thought for a long time and still do that if I'm going to express myself fully creatively, I need money in order to do that. Most of us, many of us, feel that money is the same as survival. I need money in order to survive. Questions like, how will I make rent? Money is like the bottom line thing that we need in order to meet what we think are our unmet needs. And in that, money is a lie. It's an illusion. It is what inserts itself between us and our needs and requires of us frequently behaviors in order to meet those needs. So money is a fictional story that steps between us and the meeting of our needs. And then on an even deeper level, and maybe the deepest level I can get to right now, at least until you ask me some questions, money is a jerry-rigged half solution, like a Band-Aid, but a Band-Aid that keeps expanding and expanding, that papers over distrust in community. If we had trust in each other and in the earth, money would be a joke. It would be absurd. If I trusted you to give me what I needed when I needed it, and you trusted me to give you what you need when you needed it, and we were in community where resources flowed based on where our hearts were pointing, based on where the need was, money would be an absurdity. But at some point, probably at many different points in many different cultures, there was a subtle and then less subtle rupture in trust. And I no longer believed that my needs would be met, and you no longer believe that your needs would be met simply through a gift economy. That trust got ruptured. And once that trust was ruptured, now I don't trust you anymore. Now I need an IOU. Now I need to account for things. Now I need to keep track of things. So money represents and is a false substitute for a breakdown in trust in community. And that is one of the reasons why it's extremely, extremely hard to have real, honest, and deep relationships if you have a lot of money, because you can't build real, true trust when you are constantly using the artificial version of it. Money is like a dark shadow that is absorbing all of our unprocessed wounding, and we believe that it will resolve it. But really what we're wanting underneath all of that, if we could possibly find our way through the money matrix, the money illusion, is just to be held and to hold others in loving community.
Well, I got a lot of juice for a real small squeeze there. That was nice. I want to inspect each of those three perspectives.
On great. But thanks for keeping track. Amazing.
First, I want to make sure that I captured them mentally. I'm not actually capturing them with anything.
If anyone can capture things mentally, I believe you can.
Well, let's see how well I did. So what I captured from that is, first and foremost, money is a story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story that we agree to, or we've been led to believe that we must agree to.
Mm-hmm.
We inherently give our consent to participation in a collective story,
mm-hmm.
which is the money story.
Yes.
Secondly, money is a projection of our unmet needs, or it's a thing that we project our unmet needs onto, sort of like a blank screen,
mm-hmm.
that we can project anything that we feel is lacking in our life, whether even that's both physical and material, but also mm-hmm. even emotional, spiritual,
absolutely.
Social, and so forth.
You got it.
And third, money is a substitute for real trust. It's a thing that we use as an IOU instrument, which really means I actually don't trust you fully, so I need some sort of a note that creates a contract of an obligation that you have for some future reciprocity to me.
Yeah.
Did I get that right?
Yeah. Or I'm going to store my community capital.
Yeah.
What used to be social capital, I don't trust social capital anymore. I don't mm-hmm. trust the natural way resources flow through communities. So I'm going to take that social capital and I can convert it to something I can actually literally count.
Nice. And then there was kind of like a little sprinkle on top of that three-layer cake that I caught at the end, which had to do with a place that we hide our collective shadow.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah. This is maybe the hardest one to get at. But let's say for you, money equals survival. Even though you have, this may or may not be true of Vision. I'm using you as a random hypothetical.
Sure.
Let's say you may or may not actually have enough money to live comfortably by contemporary American standards, but you need ever more money because you feel in your body that if you don't have X amount of money, you're going to die, and you have a story that you'll run out of. Housing, healthcare, nobody will support you. This is an extremely common story. Many, many people will resonate with that story I just shared. And then for me, I don't have that story. I feel very surprisingly comfortable at the idea of being homeless. And if I don't have healthcare, whatever, and maybe my parents would help me out or I'll bounce from place to place. I don't have a survival story around money in the same way I know so many of the other people do. But I really have a story that if I could only have enough money, I could create the way I want. There are books in me that would come out faster. There's podcasts I could hire a producer for. There's all these creative expressions, events I want to put together that I don't want to charge people for. I'm in the story. I'm truly in the story that I'm operating at 30% of what I could do if only I had money. So for you, money is survival. And that's because you have not worked through the place in your life where your survival has in the past been threatened. And so you're projecting the resolution of that trauma-based need onto money.
Is that a fourth different thing, or is that a thing that is encapsulated? Or
I think it's like extension of the second thing, but I think it makes the most sense if we think about it as the whole thing. It's like the dark, it's the vicious cycle that holds it all together, like the dark glue. This is the dark glue. This is why money works inside our culture.
It's almost like, the fourth thing is almost like money is an artifact of trauma bonding between us.
Yes. Or it's the collective shadow that lives, that holds together by virtue of all of our individual unprocessed shadows. So the person who thinks I need money to survive is in our culture extremely unlikely to process whatever survival trauma is giving rise to that illusion. And me, even at my level of awareness and healing, I'm still in the story. David, right now, this person with all this analysis of money is still right now in the story that I'm only operating at 30% of my capacity for lack of money. And so I haven't fully processed in my unconscious the relationship between creativity and freedom and how I felt stifled in some way. And so there are homeless people right now writing poems, feeling fully creatively expressed. And here I am bitching that I don't have enough money to self-publish my book with the illustrator I want. I'm clearly in some kind of delusion. Am I going to work through it in this lifetime? Hopefully. But I don't know. Right now I'm stuck with it. So then you and I come to make a deal with money. And really, if I give you money, I'm actually giving you the illusion that money will help you survive. And you give me money, you're giving me the illusion that I need money for creative freedom. And what makes money so freaking sticky is that it does the trick, sort of. It does the trick, sort of. So you get the money. If you feel like you're not going to survive, you pay your rent, you feel calmer, your nervous system relaxes. And now it reinforces the illusion that you need money to feel safe.
Totally.
I get my money. Somebody gives me money. I hire the illustrator that I want. The book goes out. It's a big fucking success. It makes money. And now I'm fully reinforced in the illusion that I need money to succeed, because we've all agreed on it to such an extent that it has so much power. The reason it has so much power, though, is because of all of our unprocessed wounding. It's like the root trauma is the community trauma, but then all of our traumas feed into that original collective trauma and further make it harder and harder to untangle. And it's like, this is why it's so hard to have straightforward and honest conversations about money, even with people who are like mature, even with people who do a lot of work. And you start asking, like a dear friend of mine just told me that she inherited a couple $100,000. And I could see the bravery it took for her. Like, it took bravery. Like, bravery to tell for her to tell me the amount of money that she inherited and what that meant to her and all the shame she had to work through to tell me that. And it's just so much blah.
I can certainly relate to the experience of when the money situation feels scarce or chaotic or out of control or unmanaged, how that has such ripple effects all through my psyche, and going through life in a more depressed state, going through life in a more irritable state, in a more reactive state, more susceptible to all types of triggering, more susceptible to all types of stories and distractions, versus when the money thing feels abundant or feels in control or feels stabilized and organized. Stabilized and organized. Well, organized probably for me more than the average person. Because I could even, for me personally, I can be in a scarce state with regard to money, but if it's well managed and well organized, if I ultimately feel like I have good accounting for my scarcity, I can still have an element of relaxation and an element of, more peace and calm in my life and feel overall more optimistic and positive about things, versus when, like, I don't know how much money I have. I don't know where my money is going. I don't know, I can't account for my resources. Then I feel disharmonious, disorganized, dysregulated, etc. My sense is that that's a very common, a very, very common human experience. And even for people, it's not so much even really about the quantity of the money, because I think I see this experience playing out for people at all levels of the social spectrum. People with millions of dollars, nonetheless, can feel scarce. Or people with, let's say millions of dollars of resources or whatever, can still be feeling scarce or chaotic or out of control with their money situation. It's just a matter of scale. It's just a matter of multiples of, adding zeros to the number, but the feeling is the same. So I just think that's an interesting kind of anchor point that we can all attach to for this money conversation of just thinking about, reflecting on our own relationship to money, what it's been like for us in our life, and maybe, just kind of starting to stimulate a thought process about what is our belief system about money. And you shared with me earlier that you actually hold an MBA. And so I'm curious, starting with that first point about the story of money, tell me the story of money. I'm curious. And I mean,
not the story that we're all in?
Yeah, not from your perspective per se, because I know that you've thought deeply about it and you've gone very deep in terms of some of these ideas about community and trust and things. But just tell me the surface level story of our culture, of what is the story of money?
Money is a store of value that helps us facilitate trade more efficiently than we could with any other medium of exchange. It works best generally when backed by an authority that we trust, although there have been some holes in that recently with electronic scam artist money. That was my story. There's holes in that cultural story with the rise of these electronic, not electronic money. What are they called? Bit dollars, Bitcoin,
cryptocurrency.
That's the word I'm looking for. Yeah,
sure.
On a social level, inside our culture, there are things you can do that will make you more money. You need to figure out how to value yourself in the marketplace and make yourself marketable, whether at the level of skills, so that you can be paid appropriately for your skills. If you develop your skills, you'll be able to get more money in the market, and then you can take that money that you make and use it to build a comfortable life for you and those you care about. You can also, if you do well enough, invest it wisely so that you can use your money to make more money, which is an amazing thing. And the other the other story that I definitely got a lot of in business school is if you have the wherewithal and the courage and the vision, it's possible to come up with a whole new way of making money than other people have come up with, or a slightly different way of making money. And then you are this sacred and magical being called an entrepreneur. And then if you figure out how to provide value, quote unquote, at scale to either a lot of people or to the right niche, then you can make a whole lot of money. And then you have achieved a very worthy level of status inside our culture, and you deserve a great deal of recognition for that. Money is also what makes the world go round. We know that if you want to get something done, you really need money. And there's definitely an imbalance of power, and we should probably redistribute money a little bit because the people who have it probably have too much of it. But ultimately, we need to preserve a system in which people can work hard and or innovate so that they can make money, so that they can drive growth for all of us, so that living standards can improve, so that technology can improve, and we all do better. And let us be thankful for the amazing technology of money that facilitates all of this, is the horseshit story that most of us have been taught.
That all sounds like horseshit to you?
All of it.
Every single part of it?
The whole fucking thing.
Fascinating. Okay. In the mainstream...
I mean, it's, some of it's true, and trivially true. Like,
what parts are trivial?
Like, I mean, it's trivially true that if you figure out how to sell something that the market needs, it is trivially true that you can make a lot of money at that. I mean, that's obviously I'm not debating the physics of it, but the underlying value system on which all of this story rests is total horseshit.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's exactly where I was going to start probing, was around value, the concept of value. Because the very, very first thing I think that you said, the very first line,
money is a store of value.
Yes. That's the first line of the Book of Money.
Yeah.
Is money is a store of value.
Yeah.
Do you think that's true?
I think it's got the lie in it immediately. So like everything with money, there's enough truth in it that it perpetuates. And if it didn't have truth, the story would fall away. Like the devil always says something true. The devil always offers you something you really want. The way the devil gets you is that he embeds what he really wants into what you really want. And then you make the deal. And you don't realize until your soul is sucked out of you how fucked up the deal was. So when we say money is a store of value, we have both the truth in that we can take, books off your bookshelf and reduce them to a dollar amount if you went to the bookstore. But at the same time, money, when I take all your books off your bookshelf and turn them into their market value, let's say $500, and I give you that $500 and I say, money just stored all the value of your books, your heart sinks, because the value of your book wasn't what you can get at the marketplace. The value of your books was your relationship to those books, was the markings you put in those books, was the care in which you assembled those books.
Well, how about even before we get to the markings or the care, but like, how about the information that's actually contained in the books?
And the information
is not contained in the $500.
Is not contained in the $500.
Yeah.
So when we say money is a store of value, what is the value that money is storing when we get the $500 for the books? It's storing the value of it in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
But the marketplace is not the place where we get the most value. The marketplace is the place where we get those things that money can buy.
I see where you're going.
So what it does is it takes what is of value and reduces it to the money economy. And as a result, causes us to devalue on a deeply unconscious level that we've all accepted the real value of that. And then the people who are focused on the real value, in this case, let's say the authors who are putting years and years into stories that really matter, are generally pushed to the fringe of the money economy and struggle with it. So if you create value that can be reduced to money, you thrive, you get status, you win in this game. If you create value that isn't reducible easily to money, you suffer, you struggle, and people have trouble seeing the value of what you do, because money is not just a store of value, that's the but really, in our money economy, money is the primary store of value.
This is really great.
And that's the devil. And I don't mean that in a simply metaphoric sense. I actually think like this is a demonic energy that is moving through at that phrase, money is a store of value. It's the reduction of everything beautiful and meaningful and true to a simple number. It's extracting the soul and just leaving the corpse to feed on.
Okay. Well, that hopeful imagery aside, I see your point.
Yeah.
And I think your point is very interesting, or at least stimulating. It's very stimulating to me in thinking about money more deeply and I think uncovering some realities about it that I had not really thought of before. I love the focus on this word value. I think we're right over the target right now.
We are.
And so I just want to translate everything you just said into kind of some visual imagery that was occurring to me while we're talking about specifically the books. That's a great example of how money is not a store of real value in the sense of if I have a book, I have value in the form of information. I have value in the form of maybe something that I can learn, a practical skill that I can glean from these pages,
beautiful aesthetic experience.
A fantasy world that I can escape to for hours and hours of pure joy, or a record of important history, of facts that should not be forgotten, and all that sort of stuff. If I take that book and sell it at the marketplace and receive a $50 bill, I don't have any of those things anymore. All I have is a fancy-looking piece of paper. Mm-hmm. That I hope someone will later on want to trade with me for something else that has some real value. And then we assume that there's some equivalence, that we can somehow create an equivalence of value between entirely dissimilar things, such as the difference between a book on history and a shopping cart full of groceries, or enough gas to fill up my car, or whatever. So the imagery that was kind of occurring to me is that money, you could think of money instead of as fancy looking pieces of paper or numbers in a computer account somewhere. If you imagine taking real resources, books, furniture, cars.
How about trees? How about
trees,
the natural world, lakes?
Nature, food, energy, all of these different things, these actual, real, tangible, valuable aspects of what actually creates life and meets our needs, and put it into a machine that has a giant funnel. Mm-hmm. And you're putting all of this stuff into this machine that actually just breaks it all down and reduces it to some sort of a uniform slurry of matter comes out the bottom. And we can fill glasses with that and say, well, here's your tree. Here's your car. Here's your gasoline. Here's whatever. But all you get is an identical homogeneous substance that you can say, well, this contains all of the units of value of that real thing, but it doesn't actually do any of the things that that thing does in terms of actual needs meeting. It is inherently an idea. It's a concept and an abstraction of value, of the idea of value, as if value itself is fungible in the same way that this arbitrary token is fungible.
Yeah.
There's a flaw there that you're detecting in that statement. Money is a store of value. Money is only a store of theoretical value because we choose to believe that, because we choose to agree that the inherent energy or labor or creativity or natural resources or whatever that went into any sort of object that, you know, we may place value on can be actually transmitted from place to place through this intermediary, which itself is actually valueless.
Yeah, beautiful.
That's interesting.
I would say it's I would say there's an intention behind it. Like money seeks to turn everything into money. There's a theory where, which I like generally, which is the purpose of a system is what it does. And so it's not a value neutral thing. It's in the greater sense of the word value, it's not a value neutral thing to take a book and reduce it to money and then talk about the book just in terms of its financial value, which, by the way, is what publishing companies do all day. Mm-hmm. That's a non-neutral activity. That is saying that our highest value, if you are the CEO of a publishing company, your truest highest value is the reduction of meaning to capital. Like that is your totem. Hmm. And that to me is money. And if you work in finance, you're primarily just looking at how everything does reduce to money. You're constantly reducing everything to money. The people who have the most money are those people who spend the most amount of time reducing everything to money and then trading money against itself. It just becomes more and more abstract. And the more you're involved in experiences that are fundamentally valuable outside of the money economy, like if you're waking up every day trying to love people on an individual level, if you're waking up every day trying to tell beautiful stories, you're existing on the edges of the money economy. It might give you enough to survive, but barely. It's keeping you deliberately in scarcity because you are not fully contributing to money's intention inside our culture, which is the reduction of everything to itself. And we're close. Like we're close now to where we won't have much of a natural world left. Like we will have turned the rainforests into money. We will have turned our oceans into money. We will have turned everything into money. We're taking all this diversity, like you said, putting it into a blender and spitting out money.
Hmm. Well, I want to bring up, there's a term you haven't used yet, but I want to bring it up now because of what you just said about this industry that plays this game within the realm of abstractions where money begets money, begets money, and money changes into different forms of money. And that, and the word I want to bring up is finance.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is that there's a distinction between money as a concept or a tool or a technology, if you want to think of it that way, versus finance, which is almost like a science or a domain or an industry, mm-hmm. which is built around money and which sort of is almost like a mm-hmm. virtual reality that has its own set of rules. And I think that increasingly, we as a culture and a civilization have actually lost the distinction between money and finance. And that's kind of part of the slippery slope of where we find ourselves today. Then you did invoke a term, which is economy, which I also think is different. I think an economy or the economy is a different concept from money or finance that doesn't necessarily require either per se. But we tend to mix all of these terms up in our story of, let's say, Western capitalism or American capitalism. We tend to mix these all up, like money, the economy, the financial system, so-called, you know, finance, business, entrepreneurship. There's just like this little pot that we kind of mix this into this one homogenous stew in a way where I think there's value in separating these concepts out and kind of treating them individually and noticing that the one does not necessarily need, require, or depend on the other in all cases. I think the world of finance does need and depend on money, but I don't think money necessarily needs or depends on the world of finance. And I think the economy certainly doesn't necessarily need or depend on money or finance, although certainly we've built a kind of economy that is highly dependent on both of those institutions or structures. But there's another phrase other than money as a store of value that I think often comes up in the story of money, which is money is a medium of exchange.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Does that feel a little less charged or like there's an obvious paradox in it to you versus the store of value point?
Well, there's a tragedy built into it. Similarly with money as a store of value, money as a medium exchange. I think the tragedy built into it is that when we start talking about money as a medium of exchange, we're inside a story already, or we're being forced without even noticing inside a story that we need mediums of exchange. So it's kind of like a no-brainer. And then there's the myth that money arose, turns out to be total BS, the myth that money arose through barter. There was barter, and then that got too complicated, so somebody figured out we can do it with money. That story is a 19th century capitalist myth to make money make sense to us, but it didn't actually happen.
Really?
Yeah.
Where do you get the history of money?
You can read books called The History of Money.
Okay.
You can Google like barter. Did money come from barter?
Uh-huh.
And any scholar who's looked at this is agreed that it's not the case.
Fascinating. Well, what's the Reader's Digest version of where did money really come from?
Well, it really depends on what you mean by money.
Uh-huh.
So there's multiple different strands of the origin of money, and I feel like I will stumble and bumble if I go into it. But I want to, so I'll pass on that.
Okay.
Maybe I'll pick it up later. But the money is a medium of exchange, I don't want to pass on. It is a medium of exchange, and it's tragic that we have mediums of exchange. The world of exchange is a world that has lost its sacred connection. And so what I wish we could see is like money is a substitute for a gift economy. Money is a sad substitute for a gift economy.
Hmm.
And that would feel like truer to me than money is a medium of exchange, though money is a medium of exchange.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit like saying money is a medium of exchange feels to me like saying, where do they get people off cancer? That's really bad for you.
Chemotherapy.
Chemotherapy. Chemotherapy heals cancer. You're like, no. Mm-hmm. Chemotherapy mm-hmm. is a really toxic way of treating cancer that alleviates it and in some cases triumphs over it, maybe, inside a really toxic system that created the cancer. Like,
mm-hmm.
So money is a medium of exchange. It's like chemotherapy cures cancer. Sure.
Hmm.
How do we get underneath that? Can we get underneath that?
Hmm.
Or are we already surrendered? And we are already surrendered. Like, it's so hard to even be able to say these things. If I start talking about what I'm saying here to people less thoughtful than you, it's like there's not even a receptiveness to the stuff I'm saying. It immediately gets like dismissed or thought of as woo, or it's like we're so inside the story of money that we're not even available to like see beyond it.
Well,
and even inside like crazy left, not crazy, like far left thinking, like even inside, you know, socialist thinking, they're still like, no, you still need, of course you still need money. Mm-hmm. We're just distributing it differently.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
that's right. Like, yeah. Huh. Well, okay. Well, are you saying that money is not a medium of exchange?
No.
Or are you just saying
money is a medium of exchange?
Okay.
But that is a non-neutral statement.
Okay. I'm with
you. Masquerading as a neutral one. Chemotherapy cures cancer.
I got you. Okay. What about money as a form of energy?
That's me like putting my finger in my throat.
Yeah.
There's a way in which it's trivially true.
Okay.
And like, I don't know, a bookshelf is a form of energy.
Sure.
Chocolate is a form of energy. Like,
yeah.
Calling things a form of energy is the spiritual equivalent of turning everything into money. I mean, everything is. Oh, you're not a person. You're just a form of energy. It's like, okay, well, I've taken out, by calling you a form of energy, I've taken out anything meaningful about you, and I've said something trivially true. And the reason I've taken anything meaningful out about you is because I don't want to see what's actually meaningful. So when people are saying money is just a form of energy, what I'm hearing is there are all these other aspects of money that I can't process, can't digest, can't be with. And so it's really safer for me to look at it as just the flow of energy. It's a way of compartmentalizing out those things about money that on some level we know to be true, but that we can't bear.
Interesting. There's something that you said that you just kind of invoked it again, and it jogged my memory. I wanted to kind of inspect a little bit the statement of money wants to turn everything into money. Mm-hmm. And like you alluded to the natural world, like we're turning the rainforest into money, we're turning the mountains into money, we're turning all these things into money. First of all, I think that's a very interesting concept to me, to think of money almost as like a virus itself, or like a cancer or a self-replicating machine literally wants to, like the paperclip machine that turns the world into paperclips. Yeah. It's like the money is...
It's already happened.
Turns the world into...
already have it.
Well, I want to inspect that, though. It's an interesting concept to me. I can see what you mean. Let's put it that way. I can see what you mean by that. But I want to push back a little bit on... I don't see the rainforests, let's just say, being literally converted into physical dollar bills. Maybe in some cases they are because they're made of paper. And also, I think, linen or something, but being physically converted into dollar bills, or I guess even weirder would be physically converted into zeros in a bank account. It's not that. It's being physically converted into other forms of resources, right?
But the purpose of converting it into other forms of matter is to make money. So if the rainforest is being clear cut in order to make room for cattle, because the people who are making money off those cattle don't have to deal with the collective loss that we all feel when the rainforest is cut down for their cattle, that to me is a reduction of the rainforest to money.
I get what you're saying, but I'm trying to follow me in what I'm saying here for just one second.
I will.
Because what I'm saying is, the phrase making money in itself is kind of meaningless. Making money is just making imaginary stuff in your head, right? In a way. What's actually being made is not money, it's cattle.
Right.
And then what's actually being made from cattle is people, or whoever's consuming
steaks,
the cattle, right? Is steaks, and people eat the steaks. Uh-huh. And so I'm saying, real things are actually being made. What's happening is matter is being converted into other forms of matter, generally more complex in a way, not diminishing the complexity of the rainforest.
I think by generally Easter. Simpler. Maybe so.
You know, maybe a smartphone is a highly complex system in its own right. It's a totally different type of system than natural minerals that exist in the ground or in a mountain, or all of the different forms of energy that went into producing it and running it. So my thought is that this idea of making money in and of itself is already an illusion. It's it's a part of the fantasy land that we're inhabiting in the story of money. What's really important is what is being done? What is being taken from one place, changed, and moved to another place? And money is the motivation for people doing things.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Yes. Yeah, that's cool. I like that observation.
So in a way, you could look at it as it is a medium of exchange in that way. And the kind of, let's call it the money myth, the money mythology that is sort of the basis for my understanding of what money is and what an economy is that at its most simple, money is essentially a promise to do labor. If it's a store of any type of actual value, it's a store of actual human effort. That's really the energy. That's the actual form of energy that money encapsulates.
What if I like buy land or something?
Well, you could, yes. If you're trading money for any form of property or you know, inanimate material, in other words, not directly for a service, like, hey, spend an hour of your time doing this thing for me, it would seem like, oh, money is equivalent to land or a cell phone or whatever. But what the kind of economists that I've read and paid attention to would say is that if you trace it back, if you go backwards in time far enough, you eventually get to a point where somebody did something, somebody exerted effort and produced something with their own personal labor, their own personal human energy. And that is the actual thing that the money is storing and is being traded around. In that sense, there's a sense in which you could say that money is a form of slavery, because it's essentially, it's an IOU for, you have to do work for me now. In other words, you could almost reverse the money paradigm, where the story of money in our culture is, oh, I do work to receive so that I can provide for myself and have a first make a living, literally to live, and then beyond that to experience greater and greater forms of comfort and convenience and luxury. But there's another sense in which you could look at it as it's actually exactly the opposite. It's a form of withholding, which is akin to a kind of slavery, in the sense of I give you this, and now you must do for me in return, because this dollar essentially it literally represents human labor.
Until
we get robots running around doing all of the labor that humans can do, that's what it ultimately comes down to. It's the only way that we get material pushed around and moved around and converted from one form or another is by humans doing it. And then when we get robots, then we're going to have a new kind of ethical dilemma, which is it really okay to have them as slaves instead of us?
I think we've already passed that point. We already have robots as slaves.
I have one that vacuums my floor.
Yeah, we've already normalized it.
Yeah. So I guess I'm doubly skeptical, I guess. Like, maybe I'm even more skeptical than you are in a certain way, because I look at this whole idea of finance and money makes more money, or money wants to make more of itself or something like that, as even one illusion removed from the regular illusion that we're already inhabiting, because money just doesn't really exist in the first place. It's all just people doing stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and then we may use some kind of a physical or virtual token to
keep track
of who's done what stuff for who,
and really keep track of who gets to decide. That's right.
It's a measure of influence.
Yeah,
allocating resources and people power. Yeah, yeah, that's it. But I really like, so now, like, let's see. I want to skip ahead to number three, because I also like to think about things in a historical context and in I like to deeply comprehend things going all the way back to where they originated. And so when you're talking about money as a substitute for real trust and community, that one really resonates for me, because I can see what you mean by that. And so my mind immediately starts imagining a tribal community, where there are actually some tribal civilizations,
many,
even that still
have some form of money. Yeah. That don't have money. They're both.
I don't. Yeah, maybe they do. Maybe they don't. But what I'm saying is that I think there are still some tribal communities and societies that still exist in more or less a traditional form that have not yet been assimilated into global civilization. You know, whatever that is.
Only like one or two. I think we're almost at the end of that.
Yeah. Have we run out? The last time I checked in was kind of like in the late 90s. So
yeah, I'm not sure that maybe there's one. There's really, most tribes have been corrupted by money.
Mm. Well, I think at least we seem to believe that there was a point in time where there were these tribal societies that did operate on what I think you would call a gift economy type of model. It was several, you know, family groupings. It was a population of probably less than 150. It was
Not necessarily. There's this, you know, if you read The Dawn of Everything by David Graeber, I'm proud to say was a friend of mine, his partner on it, whose name escapes me. They talk about how there were some cultures that existed without money that had might have had thousands of people.
Okay. I'm open to that. I don't think it matters to my point, the point I'm trying to make. There is the I can't remember the name, whose theory it is, but the magic number of 150 tribal communities or something along those lines. But I think the point I'm trying to make is just that there we do seem to believe that these models existed at a point in time, that there is a way of organizing society and economy at a particular scale, question mark about where that scale may or may not break down, but where everyone was just working together to make a living in common unity, community, right? Mm-hmm. Just, you know, I do my thing and you do your thing. And when you need something, I help you out. Give and receive, sacred reciprocity. Why? Because we're all surviving together, hopefully thriving together. There's not really a need for a medium of exchange.
Right.
When
you have love.
Yeah. Or when you have a certain kind of intimacy, mm-hmm. a certain kind of shared container, mm-hmm. let's just say, where it's like there's really no space for money because everything is so integrated. I guess that's how I imagine it. It's an integrated economy. That's how I see it or imagine it. So when does trust break in an integrated economy, tribal community situation? One thought that occurs to me is pretty obvious. What if two communities bump into each other and want to exchange resources? Maybe community A has some specialization or natural resource mm-hmm. that's just their natural wealth from the area that they reside in. Community B has something different. We could both benefit from exchanging our natural gifts with each other. But you're not part of my tribal community. You're not my family. I don't even know if maybe you're going to attack me later. I don't know. Is that the beginning of where we need to outsource our trust to some neutral medium of exchange? I know you don't think that phrase is neutral, but I don't know. Where does it come from?
We're in like the place where history meets mythology, meets imagination.
Fair enough.
I liked your example, though. I would bet that when those tribes came together, if they had been operating independently inside two gift economies, what would have happened was they would have gifted to each other. And then maybe somebody killed somebody from the other tribe. And now there was no more trust, so they weren't going to just gift to each other. I'm just making this stuff up, but like, who knows what there was. It's, you know, like any trauma, it's not so much what's happened. It's the inability to repair. So there's going to be breakdowns in trust in any family. There's going to be traumas and schisms, and in community, there's traumas and schisms. I think that goes all the way. I bet you they're elephants are having trauma and schisms. Like, it feels like something got ruptured permanently, or at least all the way up till now. There was just like some moment where we couldn't go back and heal it. Some moment where we couldn't go back and grieve. Some moment where we just kept going and going and then kept building on the fact that we didn't do the work. And now we're here. And like the world is at this tipping point because we just still haven't done the work. And we're still outsourcing this communal healing to this money machine.
Mm.
And everything is now like almost ripped apart. Like,
well, I can certainly relate to what you're saying in the sense that I mean it seems obvious to me, but then again, there's certain things that I've read that help to program me for this, you know, this particular belief system. It seems obviously to me that our civilization, so-called, our global, what has now sort of become a global civilization, is the product of a runaway pathologic human template that originated somewhere, but has been literally gobbling up all of the people and all of the resources of the entire planet for some number of thousands of years. That's what it looks like to me, but I didn't create that idea myself. Have you ever read anything by Daniel Quinn?
Yeah.
So, like Ishmael?
Well, yeah. Yes. I haven't read that, but I know about it, and it's on my list. And then, what's the name of the demon that, is that him who says that? There's somebody who says, there's like a name for the demon of rapacious Western civilization, particular demon that an indigenous culture saw in us.
Maybe there is something about a demon in there. I don't remember that specifically, but the word that he uses for the specific culture. So the idea generally goes that there was a point in time where, you know, there were some millions of humans on the planet, and there were many, many thousands of cultures that were small and local and tribal. But he calls all of those different tribal civilizations at a certain point of time, they all followed a certain template that he calls levers, the lever template, which essentially means we're going to leave everything alone. We're going to leave you alone. We're going to leave you alone. We'll leave these resources here for the next person. We're levers, essentially. And of course they would make a living for themselves from the land, and different tribes didn't, you know, necessarily get along or share gifts with each other. And they might have some, you know, some territorial conflicts about establishing where their boundaries are and things like that. But they weren't declaring war on each other. They weren't conquering each other. They weren't taking each other's resources and people and, you know, assimilating their cultures and things. And then an innovation occurred. Some culture somewhere flipped and created a new program, which is called Taker, the Taker culture. And the Taker culture is exactly the opposite. It's, we are going to declare war on you. We're not just going to compete with you for living from the land, but we're actually going to take from you with force and get bigger and then take more and get bigger and then take more and get bigger and so forth. And we essentially, according to this school of thought, we are the takers. We are the result of the takers that has almost, but not quite, taken everything.
Yeah, that feels right.
And so we're this monolithic, I guess, somewhat cancerous culture.
Yeah.
That's the same culture, and this is in the use of the term culture. It's not this particular culture spans geographies and languages and skin colors and ethnicities. Mm-hmm. It's not about what language you speak or what you look like to be a part of this culture. It's about your thought process. Mm-hmm. It's about your mental programming, the story that you inhabit. Ultimately, it's the taker story. And I think that's exactly that's the money story is merely a piece
of the taker story.
I think so.
Yeah.
Does that ring true for you?
It does. It's a great facilitator of the taker story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like in service to the taker story. Like the taker story is like, oh, I have a friend that I can use money. He'll make this go so much faster.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like it's a technology. It's an accelerator, just like a plow or a sword or anything that lets you just take more quickly. Except this one kind of breaks the rules of even the physical world.
Yeah,
and
well,
there's really no limit to how much you can take.
This one is a form of like really widely adopted black magic. I mean, money is a form of dark magic. It's like cast a spell. Not money is the spell that has been cast over our collective psyches, and we are in its spell all the time, and it's so hard to see past it.
What's the spell, or what is that black magic?
Well, it's the way it's worked on me, for instance. It's like oh, I need money to be creatively expressed. And that's true enough, because if I don't have money, I can't do all these things that my soul really wants to do. And that's because you agree that I need to pay you to do something. So it's the black magic is that it doesn't exist. We're all in a story that it does exist. Even those of us like you and me who realize that it doesn't really exist still act as if it exists as necessity in order to meet whatever needs we haven't fully healed from in ourselves.
Well, if you're talking to, like, let's say you're with a group of people and everybody believes that there's a 12-foot tall, you know, blue alien named Ralph.
Yeah.
That's part of the group, and everyone's interacting with Ralph as if he's there and real. You don't see Ralph, but like,
you're crazy.
You kind of got to pretend like you do because everything revolves around Ralph, apparently,
then,
in this room.
And then at some point, somebody will be like, Ralph is just an energy. Like, you don't have to tell us he's imaginary. He's just an energy.
Right.
And if you do the things that align with Ralph, you will get love and support. So what's wrong with you? Why don't you? And then some people are like, I have a great relationship with Ralph. I've really figured out Ralph. And then everyone's like, oh, how do you figure out Ralph?
Ralph hates me.
Yeah. And Ralph is not the one who does the spell. Mm. There's a force behind Ralph that is doing the spell. Mm. So that we all see Ralph, and that thing is having its needs met through Ralph. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the piece of it where I don't want to say you lose me a little bit. I guess for me, I have a sense that money itself is actually neutral. That's my sense.
Is everything neutral?
I don't want to go down. I don't want to go too far down a rabbit hole, because all I was trying to say is that. No, you're fine. All I was trying to say is that it's not immediately resonant for me that money needs to have a malicious, destructive, dark, negative force behind it, like a puppeteer with a puppet. However, I believe that it probably does, but I don't think it must. Let's put it that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess I would agree with you. Then intention has a lot to do with it. Maybe we can try to redeem money here at the end of our conversation.
I hope so.
The redemption of money. And I'd like to
at least at some point pivot to
what's the
alternative? Ultimately, I want to get to, you know, what is a gift economy? What is that? What does that even mean? What does that look like? Can there be money in a gift economy? Would it actually be good for there to be money in a gift economy, but maybe utilized in a different way, or maybe with a different story that creates it, or something along those lines?
I would say, like, my belief is that right now money is a pathway to hell, and it's leading us there very efficiently, but it doesn't have to be. So in the way that money is neutral, money, we are learning through money, and we have hopefully reached the end of reducing these things of great value to this arbitrary figment in our collective imagination, hopefully. And the redemption of money is when we start putting money toward that which has non-monetary value. So we can reverse the whole trend of reducing that which has value to money by putting money toward that which is ultimately priceless.
Like what?
Like, it's small versions of this we experience all the time, where we want to give money to somebody because what they did really meant something to us. And we are offering the money as a kind of sacred reciprocity. It's really taking on its most beautiful purpose. Mm-hmm. And that is how money is redeemed.
Hmm.
When we put our money into something because we genuinely feel and believe it in our hearts, and we value it in a way that money cannot ever capture.
Aha.
Then we are putting the force of our current story into the general repair of the world. and of community.
You brought it right back to what I envisioned earlier when we were talking about, when we were focused on that word value.
Yeah.
And I felt that there was something really core in that word in using it in a different way,
mm-hmm.
which is there's this homogeneous idea of value as this universal energy or something, which may or may not represent human labor. But the word value also is personal.
Mm-hmm.
And like a different question than how much value is money is what kind of value does this money represent?
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? It could be used in a different way that has to do with exchange of values. Am I making sense here?
Yeah, I think you're making some sense. I think I can make it make even more sense maybe if we think about the way we use our time.
Mm-hmm.
And in the capitalist equation, money is time, so it'll work here good enough. It's like, are we spending our time doing things we don't fully believe in order to make money? Then we're reducing our time to money. Or are we spending our time to do things that really genuinely matter to us?
Yeah.
And then our time is now sacred. So money, similarly, are we putting our money into things so that we can make more money? Are we putting our money into things that we can mindlessly consume? Are we putting our money into things we truly believe in,
mm-hmm.
like at the level of our heart, at the level of our soul? But more and more of us are wanting that kind of alignment in our lives. And then money can be an accelerant of that. It can be like, oh, I'm putting my money where my heart is. I'm putting my money where my soul is pointing. I am now fully aligned, and now it's accelerating my expression, expansion, and healing through giving it out. And as a result, it's moving through the culture, accelerating everyone else's expression, expansion, and healing.
Right. But even in what you're saying right now, you are expressing a particular value system. You're expressing your values.
Yes.
So you're drawing a contrast between, let's say, mindless consumption,
yeah,
which is one value system,
yeah,
versus doing things that you really believe in or engaging in expressions of your heart and soul.
Yeah.
These are different values.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm saying is I have a sense that, well, first of all, I think that part of the old school story of money, at least again, I'm kind of quoting, you know, some, let's say, Austrian or kind of libertarian type economists in their sort of, I don't want to say idolization exactly, but they certainly...
That's the perfect word.
They certainly think money's pretty rad. Like, they think it's cool.
I literally think that's exactly the right word.
Okay.
It is an idolatry.
Let's just say that's what it is, or let's just say at the very least there's a respectful honor. It has a place of honor to them. And one of the reasons that it has a place of honor is because it does allow different people to have different values and to allow them to maximize their own personal flourishing as at an individual level, their own personal flourishing within their scope of values where, hey, I want, you know, a big TV and lots of vacations and, you know, to eat cotton candy every day or whatever those things are that I personally like. Those are my values. And I can exchange money for those things. You, on the other hand, prefer spiritual experiences and beautiful trips to beautiful, you know, remote locations and a much simpler lifestyle. You can exchange your money for those things and give the rest away to charity if you like. And that's an expression of your values. So I think there is a piece of the story, at least the story, that suggests that that's one of the ways that money is useful. But I think that there's something that you were expressing a moment ago that I'm really trying to articulate if I can, because it's kind of coming through for me, but it's a really new thing that's just starting to form that has something to do with what if we had a relationship with money, which is to say an arbitrary medium of exchanging energy with each other, if we wanted to define it that way, where I'm actually able to communicate my values through that. Like, because that's what it sounds like you're trying to say that she'd like to do. You want to have money, and you'd encourage people to use money to express themselves and their values, to share those with the world.
No.
That's not what you're saying?
No, I'm saying something stricter, which is like, not all values are created equal. In the immortal words of my friend John, he said something really beautiful. He said, some version of all this community talk is really nice, but at the end of the day, each of us has our own separate bank accounts. And I really feel the tragedy of that. And that story is a story that values the individual over the collective,
mm-hmm.
and values my autonomy over the rainforest.
Mm-hmm. I want you to articulate something fundamentally different for me then, because what I was hearing you say a moment ago is still very much rooted in that same story of, I've got my money, but you have a particular opinion, yeah, about what would be good for me to do with it. But what's a radically different story?
Not so much what would be good for you to do with it. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, when we do this, when we grow up enough collectively to work past the illusion of money by putting our money back into things that are inherently valuable. Maybe that's the key word. Back into things that are inherently or deeply valuable, not based on what I value or you value, that there is a higher, there is a cosmology,
mm-hmm,
in which certain things are more valuable. Like the rainforest, an old growth forest is more valuable than any amount of money you can put on it.
Mm.
I, there's no deal that you can make for a forest that's 500 years old. There's literally no deal that is the right amount.
Mm.
The sacred is the center of a healthy, balanced world. And as we align our money with that which is sacred, money will cease to exist. It will leave us. It will leave us like, oh, you've learned your lesson. Thank you. I don't think we can just bypass that journey and be like, oh, we don't need money. We have to actually transmute money back into community, back into love, in order to finish collectively this insane money journey that humans are on right now.
I think I see it now. Okay. So the core of the value conversation is actually, in your opinion, I'm trying to encapsulate what I think I'm hearing you saying. Ultimately, our dysfunction with money is an expression of our dysfunction personally and as a society. In other words,
yes,
it is the expression of our values.
Yes.
The problem is those values are fucked up.
Yes.
Okay. I can see that.
Yes.
That makes sense to me. So what does a gift economy look like? Or what is a different society that's using money in a different healthy way look like?
Well, I think money is like a transitional technology in this story that I'm creating here.
I can see that too.
So it's we move out of it and it starts to lose its value. The way everything has started to lose its value as it becomes money, money will start to lose its value as the things we put it into regain their right value.
Oh, fascinating. Okay.
And if then more and more of us start doing that, like redeeming money for that which is genuinely sacred, I think at some point it will shift to where we all start recognizing, obviously, that things are sacred and cannot anymore be converted into money.
Mm.
And we start supporting people who are doing sacred work because we now see it as so obvious. It's going to be so obvious. Like, we can't stop ours. And society and communities will organize around that which is sacred when enough money goes toward that which is sacred.
Mm.
Like, the story will switch. And instead of valuing money above all things, which is what our culture does now, will value, I mean, it's so obvious what our hearts and souls tell us actually is a value when we heal and get centered and listen to God, listen to the divine, listen to the deepest truth that moves through us. I think Charles Eisenstein describes it really well in The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, one of my favorite books of all time. Everything that is given freely and with love. And everything that is received because one genuinely needs it and is nourished by it and is grateful for it. This is not that hard to imagine in little pockets. Some families achieve measures of this just between them. friends achieve this in moments and in pockets. And, you know, you could spend a few weeks in a summer camp and feel what this feels like sometimes. Probably going to look like a lot of smaller communities oriented around land and oriented around the sacred and oriented around each other. And those communities will make things that feel really aligned with those communities to make, and will give them to other communities joyfully, who then receive them joyfully in a world where we know that we are going to be resourced because we're all now in a new story, not in a story that we can't trust each other and therefore we need a store of value, therefore that we need to accumulate in order to be safe and then manipulate other people into believing that this is the ultimate store of value. We're out of that story and we're going to enter this other story where what my heart is telling me to do, I'm going to honor because it feels right, and you're going to receive and you're going to feel grateful because that feels right. And that's the whole exchange. We don't need to figure out anything else. Like, God or the universe or nature already imbued us with the technology of healthy exchange. It's already in our nervous system. It's called giving and receiving. It's called gratitude and love. Like, it's generosity, hearts, care, compassion. We already have all of those technologies. We've just gotten away from them. But our new story can be like, oh, our body knows what the right thing is. Something like that.
I like it. I'm imagining it. You had your eyes closed while you were saying all that. And I didn't have my eyes closed. I was watching you, but I'm imagining in my mind's eye, my mental projector, how these communities look. And I think in a lot of ways, there might be a lot more simplicity to life. Mm-hmm. There might be less technology in some cases. There might be a return to certain more traditional ways of living or ancestral ways of living. And I think that we also have a beautiful opportunity to utilize this incredible technological flourishing that this monetary mm-hmm. phase of our evolution has helped to create, along with all of the baggage that it created, where we might yet be able to micromanufacture and mm-hmm. have abundant energy sources and have, you know, fully technological micro communities and societies, maybe even macro societies that can continue to create an even more and more imaginative lifestyle for us as time goes on.
May it be so.
But I see there being low-hanging fruit here in terms of an opportunity for people who are so inclined, who resonate with these concepts that you and I have been kicking around of what could a new story be? What could a new story look like? Is this story that we've been taught and told and even indoctrinated into from our earliest age all it's cracked up to be? Or is there something missing? Are there contradictions? Is there some kind of toxin packaged in there that we haven't fully detected? And so I think for anyone so inclined to be curious about how could we move out of that story and into a new one, you mentioned a phrase earlier called sacred reciprocity, which I think is also a phrase used by Charles Eisenstein, you know, his explorations of a new paradigm of economics and things. And you know that I'm a proponent of something that I call sacred reciprocity, and other people have also referred to it as value for value. It's the simplest trick, but I think it can be a very powerful element of how we build a bridge, because it doesn't require getting rid of money. It doesn't require changing our economic model, you know, or upending our financial system in any way. But it does turn our thinking on its head with regard to how we exchange energy with each other. And that just simply is, and this, I believe, perhaps this is also a stepping stone to what we may call a gift economy. But the trick is just simply, I will do for you first. And then you reflect back to me what you feel that was worth, whatever that was, instead of us, like, let's say, agreeing on a price and then a very suspicious way, like, okay, you give me yours and I'll give you mine.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm actually just going to give. I'm just going to give you mine.
But if you don't get anything back, how does that feel?
It doesn't feel good.
Yeah. I've tried this and I've had some success.
It has happened for sure. And it doesn't feel good. But what I've found in the last 2 years that I've really embraced that in kind of all of my different approaches to providing service and providing value in the world is that I have received more than the baseline expectation that I set. I've actually received more in return. I think part of that is because I try really hard. I'm incentivized to do a really, really good job, the best that I possibly can. I'm also incentivized to, you know, be diligent about who I choose to serve. And the other thing that's important to me about value for value is I open myself to more possibilities than just money in that. Like, I'm open to being resourced in different ways. Like, is money scarce for you? Well, okay. Like, what other value would you potentially have to offer? Or what other value could actually be meaningful to you to give that creates the feeling of a equitable exchange, sacred exchange?
I think
if we embraced it, I think if enough of us embraced it, because I know that I've
gone in and out of it. I really struggle with it.
It's not easy. You know, you're fighting uphill because everybody still believes in Ralph. You know, it's like you're trying to talk people into, like, okay, for the moment, let's pretend Ralph doesn't exist. How would we interact with each other?
Yeah.
But I mean, I've flipped a lot of people. I've flipped the light switch on for a lot of people just in that approach where, you know, sometimes people are really skeptical and they're like,
yeah,
that's not going to work for you. It's like, well, it's working for me to a level so far. You know, other people are just absolutely impressed with it, you know, or just that is really, really cool and courageous, and I fully support it. And those are the folks that really embrace the model and tend to give, you know, well more than I might have expected. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there. It's like,
I like that. Stuff. I like that. I mean, I love the experimentation, and this is like any way we can try to find a way through this Maya, this illusion, while still operating inside the illusion, like, is better than just mindlessly operating inside the illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Where I've found the most satisfaction is when I have been able to find a sponsor for the work that I do and then do my work and for free, or offer it completely as a gift without even accepting money in return. What I love the most is, like, somebody gives me money and then I offer something to people and I refuse to take money. And that is scrambles the brain.
It's disrupting the program, yeah.
It really disrupts the program on the part of the receivers. It scrambles the programming. That's been my experimentation, but I'm actually not a bad fundraiser, but I'm certainly no master. And so I've tried your way. It's also been a struggle for other reasons. And then I've tried, like, just charging the amount of money that would feel good to receive. And then I end up, and that's it. And then I end up working with people that I don't feel as good about because they're just paying for it and I feel used. It's like, it's a shit show.
Well, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that value for value is a program that I've used to successfully get rich.
Yeah.
That hasn't
or even happened. To get to a place of, like, genuine ease and comfort.
There's a level of ease and comfort that would be nice to achieve as yet. But I think what I'm trying to demonstrate, I believe I'm certainly demonstrating it, is that that's not what motivates me.
Yeah.
That's not the point.
Yeah, well, that's beautiful.
Of my life. You know, would I like to be comfortable? Sure. Would I like for my life to be easeful? Of course.
Yeah.
Do Do I want to have all my needs met? You know, do I want to feel like I'm flourishing as a person? Yeah. And, you know, at least for me and my value system, all of those things don't really include a yacht or, you know, multiple homes or, you know, a large bank account or things like that. I'm more interested in other things. And in particular, I'm interested in, you know, moving the ball forward from a perspective of society and development of our human experience toward the kind of thing that you and I are talking about, which is, you know, I imagine something that feels more tribal and communitarian and sacred, where everyone is having their needs met and flourishing as people, and where we actually all don't have this stress in our life that this thing called money seems to have created, even at the same time as it's created, I think, a certain fuel and fire and motivation for a lot of this kind of technological development, which in its own right has side effects, which are costly, that I think is those costs are catching up with us on a global and civilizational level, and it's time for us to grow up to the next stage of responsibility for ourselves and our world.
Amen.
And that feels like a good place to kind of bring the plane in for a gentle landing. I also want to just reflect to you real quickly that, you know, I mentioned my philosophy on value for value, and I just want to reflect to you that I'm hearing that approach that you espoused also, which is different, but I like it. And I just wanted to anchor it in our conversation, this idea of taking all of this so-called value or so-called energy or whatever it is that we've amassed in this abstraction called money and actually converting it back in the same way that we'd convert energy into matter in a physical sense, converting it back into things with tangible value.
Or intangible, things with...
Things with inherent value is the word you used. Things with inherent value or sacred value. I really like that concept. I'm just anchoring myself to that because it's not a thought that I'd really had before.
Mm.
But I like that.
All right.
Beautiful conversation, my friend. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Vision. It's been a joy.
I really appreciate it. I love you, brother.
All right.
Thanks for joining me for this sacred conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And don't forget that the conversation can always continue. We can build on a topic that we've already talked about, and we can also start new topics and see how they all weave together. And that's just the exciting thing about this whole journey of exploration, is we don't know where it's going to go, but I'm really excited to find out with you. Please don't be shy to reach out and schedule your sacred conversation on whatever topic is interesting to you. Thanks a lot, and I look forward to talking with you soon.